Okay, so apologies for those that were expecting Mark Rhino to be speaking today. He couldn't make it, so I'm the stand-in for today. So you got a stand-in speaker and a stand-in topic. So the topic is we're actually going to talk about virtual threads, which is part of Project Loom. Charlie mentioned a bit of it in his previous talk, and we're going to talk about what we're working on in this area. So Project Loom, I'm not going to go through all the project. There's a lot of material out there that you can actually search, and most of it is actually pretty good. At a high level, what Project Loom in OpenJDK is about is really about an upgrade to Java's concurrency model. It's about enabling much more higher scale server applications with very easy to write code. I'm not going to go through all of that, as I said, but the main thing I'm going to talk about is virtual threads, which is, or Charlie called them lightweight threads in the previous slide. It's all about having much more lighter weight type of threads for execution. So think about replacing tasks with thread per task models, and thread per connection, that kind of thing. There's other things that we're working on, structured concurrency and some other features. They're topics for other talks. So we've been working on this feature for a long time. This is one of these features that requires jacking up the house, replacing the foundations, putting the house back down without actually breaking anything. I think we've actually been mostly successful on that. It went through a couple of preview releases in 19 and 20. We made it a permanent feature in 21, been well received by the ecosystem in general. If you actually look at all of the frameworks and libraries out there, they've actually got something working with virtual threads in a very short period of time. That's one of the nice things about having things in preview for a couple of releases is allows these frameworks to try things out and actually find issues. The big thing about and why there's such interest in it is because it allows applications and developers to move away from sort of the world of scalability that they had before, where they had to go to async and reactive, which actually is incompatible with a lot of the things in the Java platform, particularly around things like debugging and just being able to get your right mental model of actually what code is executing. So overall, we're in a pretty good shape. Performance is actually in pretty good shape. Reliability is pretty good. There's a couple of rough areas around performance that we need to work on. We'll talk about that another time. So what I do want to talk about is the other 90%. This is one of the things about these big features is you get the first 90% done, and then you got to figure out how to get the other 90% done. And we do have some quality of implementation issues. One of the compromises that was made in order to actually to get this feature in is that we didn't do a nice job on Java monitors. So I want to talk a bit about today because that is by far the top pain point, the second top pain point, and the third top pain point that people actually trying out virtual threads for the last last couple of years is running into. I'm guessing that anyone that actually has tried virtual threads or read some of the articles is people always have these gotchas type of sections in their blogs and articles, and it's all about pinning. So I want to talk a bit about that today. I also want to talk about a few things that we're doing around expanding the set of libraries that actually work well with virtual threads. There's other projects that we're actually working on, as I said, that's for another day. Okay, in order to actually understand some of the slides that I'm going to go through and the material that I'm going to talk about is you have to have some little bit of an understanding as to how virtual threads are actually implemented. So there's an underlying concept in the Hotspot VM, which is support for delimited continuations. It's not something that's exposed generally. It's just something that's there for the underlying construct that virtual machines is actually built on. And so what happens is that a virtual thread essentially wraps one of these continuations so that when a thread needs to block because of a lock or an I/O operation or something like that, that translates to the continuation yielding, and then when it actually continues again, it's like the thread continues execution again. Now, in order to be able to actually do a threading library in Java, you actually need to combine it with some kind of a scheduler. The scheduler that we're actually combining it to for now is the fork join, pool, thread pool that's been in Java for quite some time. And that's actually a work stealing scheduler. We're using it in very, very different ways than it's used for things like parallel streams. We're using more kind of in FIFO mode. But you get the obvious kind of default parallelism, which is based on the number of cores, although it is a little bit dynamic, and I'll get into that in a few minutes. So mental model to think about anyway is that you've got this sort of magic with continuations. We're combining with a scheduler, and that scheduler is managing a set of threads. The mental model to think about is walking around with a little kid on your shoulders. The platform thread or the carrier thread is carrying the little child around, which is the virtual thread on its shoulders. When the child wants to stop and do something, you take them off, drop them down. Some other adult then comes along, or the other guardian picks them up and moves them on their shoulders. So that's essentially sort of what to think about with virtual threads. Okay, so in order to talk through some of these slides, I'm going to use a kind of the same sort of layout in all of these slides. And so what I'm going to have is there's going to be a little bit of code example on the left, and then I'm going to show some stacks on the right side. They're color-coded, and I'll show you these just to give you an idea what's actually going to happen. The thread that is going to be the subject of this talk, we're actually just going to give it an ID. It's number 22. We've doubled down on thread IDs quite a bit in the platform the last couple of years. So here, what we're going to do here is we're going to have a bit of code that's executed by virtual thread number 22. In this case, for the first example, we're actually going to use a semaphore. Think about a semaphore as something that has a number of permits. You actually acquire a permit. And run some critical code, and then when you're done with the permit, you actually return it back to the semaphore with a release. So typically, the typical idea that you actually use is acquire and then release at the end, and use the try resources construct. Okay, so very, very simple. So let's see what actually happens when a virtual thread goes and executes this code. So the arrow here, just think of the red arrow as kind of like a program point, program counter. That's kind of where we are. On the right side now, we see our first sort of stack traces here. There's actually two threads in the picture here. What you actually see at the top, and by the way, the stacks are in all of these slides, grow from the top to top down. So the orange brownie frames that you see at the top there, they're actually the fork join pool thread that's actually carrying the virtual thread. And the green frames that you see there are the virtual thread. So I've just merged them there together because that's actually what you have on the native thread underneath the covers. So when we get to doing a semaphore acquire, what we see is in green here. If you look down right at the bottom, the frame there is actually semaphore.acquire. So we're about to call this guy, and we'll actually see what actually happens when we call semaphore acquire. Okay, so semaphore acquire gets to this point here. Now, every good movie needs a villain, and I need a villain here. So in this case, let us assume that the villain is Andrew, and he actually has the permit for this semaphore. So what's going to happen is this virtual thread has to go and park because it can't acquire a semaphore. So what we see here is we're going down through the Java util concurrent code to try to acquire the semaphore. There's no permits available, so the thread has to park. What actually happens is it bottoms out at the bottom trying to do a park, which will actually yield the continuation. And there, this is where the magic occurs. The thread is now parking, and magically its frames get removed from the native thread stack, and the worker thread or the fork join thread is able to go and do other work. So that's actually what happens, sort of at a high level with virtual threads. Now, Andrew is finished with the semaphore and is doing a release. So he's returning back the permit back to the semaphore. So now we're actually going to look at what happens here now when the virtual thread is actually going to continue. So remember, our virtual thread is waiting to acquire the semaphore. Andrew is doing a release, and that goes and triggers goes through the Java util concurrent code, and it'll bottom out then doing an unpark of the virtual thread that's actually waiting, which will do the continue. And what it's actually really going to do is actually schedule the task that's associated with the virtual thread back to the scheduler so that it actually can continue again. It's very, very kind of straightforward. It's just submitting the virtual thread back to the scheduler so it can continue. So back to our slide again. So what happens is we'll assume the scheduler has now started executing this code again. It'll return back from the park that we were on earlier on. And magically, the frames start popping off, and we go into our try block, and we are done. So that's sort of thing how things actually work with parking and unparking, and how they actually integrate with the scheduler. Now we get into the sort of the problem areas and where we have the pain points with virtual threads today. So I'm going to go through two scenarios. One of them is parking while holding a monitor. I mentioned about all these blogs that have these gotchas at the end. This is essentially what they're actually trying to show you in these blogs. So we've taken the same example, but we've actually put it into a synchronized block. So the synchronized block here is so that's kind of think of that as the monitor enter. Here's the monitor exit. Same thing if this was a synchronized method. The code that we had in the previous section is exactly the same. So what happens is we're going to do the acquire here. Andrew, our villain again, is actually holding the permit for the semaphore. So this virtual thread has to go and park. So what happens this time is we're going to try to park, but we're actually holding a monitor. So this yield down the bottom fails. Why does it fail? Well, we'll get into why it actually fails in a second. But something, we're not able to actually go and release the carrier thread to do other work here. This is actually why we have you get performance issues and why we say that monitors lead to a quality implementation issue is because of this issue here. Now, what actually happens in this particular case is that instead of actually failing, it actually falls back to actually to park on the carrier. And the semaphore in this case works exactly the same as it would if you were able to unmount. We're just not able to unmount. We can't let the carrier go away and do other work. And right, why do we have this problem? So we have this problem because of the way that monitors are implemented in the Java VM. There's different kind of locking modes. A lot of this is sort of beyond where I typically work. But in Roman's talk earlier on, he actually shows some of this where the fast locking type is essentially putting a pointer into the object back into a lock record that's actually in the stack. Oh, if we that, then we can't actually start removing frames that when we unmount. There's also these inflated cases where you're actually building up a waiter list of who's actually waiting for the monitor, and what goes onto that wait list is actually the VM's internal Java thread, which is essentially the carrier thread in this case. So these are the reasons why, at least in this particular locking mode, that you cannot release the carrier at this point. And so there's magic in the implementation to track monitor usage to prevent this happening. There's another locking mode which is the newer one, the lightweight one, where there's a per thread little stack lock, and that's got issues as well because that's actually associated with the carrier thread, not with the virtual thread. So what do we do about this? So there's a sort of larger, longer-term effort that has kind of been underway. I think I saw Robin Ian here at one point. He actually started this work to actually completely re-examine and do a new implementation of Java monitors. Do it in Java rather than actually in the VM, because there's a lot of legacy code and there's a lot of history there. Now, that is a longer-term effort. There's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of exploration. But we needed a plan B, and plan B involved a hero, and the hero in this case is Patricio in the hotspot team decided to go and have a go at actually trying to do a plan B, which is change the existing object monitor implementation to work with virtual threads. So what he actually did was he's come up with there's several steps in this, and this by the way, this work is all actually in the Loom repo. So what he actually does is for the stack lock cases is he just inflates, and then for the inflated state he's actually for the moment has the VM actually doing a stack walk to actually replace the owner, so that it's actually not the Java thread. The VM's view of the thread is actually the Java thread. So that's a little bit expensive, but it actually does work. And it's a solution for the lightweight locking mode as well, where the lock stack actually moves at the mount and the unmount time. There's other work that's actually going on in parallel. Some of the work that Colleen Phillimore is actually doing about changing the lock ownership to be the thread ID. Once that work actually comes in, that means that you actually can eliminate the stack walk, you eliminate all the GC overhead, you eliminate all of the actual overhead there of this, which is actually quite nice. So a lot of pieces from a lot of people are coming together, which is nice. So this is working in the Loom repo for the moment. So we'll go back to our slides again, and what would happen with that example if we actually run it with the some of the builds that we have from the Loom repo today. So when we actually do our acquire, we bottom out again at the yield as before, but this time it actually succeeds. We release the carrier to go off and do other work. All very positive, so that is good. So that's one of the pain points with pinning, and it'll be wonderful actually to get that in. Second scenario then is the contended monitor case, and that one is you have an example like this. In this case, is I've got rid of the semaphore from this example, but I'm actually going to block here. So we assume again now that Andrew is actually holding a lock this time rather than the semaphore. And here we have our virtual thread number 22 is going to attempt to do a monitor enter at this point. And what happens today is it actually blocks when at that monitor enter. So what's going on here is a contended monitor is actually a call into the runtime. It's essentially parking in the runtime. This is something that has to be, we have to remove that and essentially pop all those frames in order to be able to actually to deal with this. So the way things are actually working at the moment is what Patricia has come up with is that essentially allows the VM to do a yield while it's from in the runtime. So normally we actually would do these yields from the Java side. So it copies the frames off the stack into the heap, just like we would we would do it a normal yield and freeze. And what it does is it actually puts the virtual thread onto the wait list for the lock. And at a high level, it's as if we're actually doing a yield at that point. There's a bit of magic that goes on with where it actually has to return back as if it owned the lock, and then you've got to run the stub that actually goes and actually does some fix ups, and there's VM magic that actually happens. But essentially, you're returning back to Java in a kind of a blocking mode, and then we can actually fix up the state and move it to its block mode so that the thread is actually blocked. So what I've put in here is just to give you, just to kind of, you can visualize how this works. We do our monitor enter, which this could be a synchronized method as well, and it's as if we're actually calling into yield at that point. So that's actually very, very nice. That actually can work. So when Andrew releases the lock, then we just continue on, and when we do that, what happens is Andrew releases the lock. We've now got virtual thread 22. How do we actually integrate back into the scheduler to get that to run again? And the way it actually works is it actually just moves the thread into a list, and an unblocker thread will actually unblock it. So for those that understand how reference processing work in the GC, this is essentially kind of like another reference handler. It's essentially queuing up objects that get handled by a Java thread. So the unblocker then just snapshots that list, and then it just wakes up those threads, which puts it back into the scheduler's queue. So that's all very nice. So in our example here is that Andrew has released the lock, and we queue up that virtual thread to actually continue, and it gets scheduled, and it continues execution inside the synchronized block. Very, very nice. So okay, high level question then, does this actually solve all of our pinning issues? And the answer is no, there's always work to do. There's issues with native frames. You can't actually yield with a native frame on the continuation stack. That's not a problem I think that we will ever address. There's a lot of unsolvable issues there. There are other things that go along with monitors. There's object weight, and it's important that we actually make progress on that one. There's an ideas on how to improve that one. And then there's the other more difficult one, which is class initializers. Because class initializers will require more surgery in the VM in order to be able to address it. So these are things that are not addressed with what's in the Loom repo now, but are things that have to be addressed over the next while in order to eliminate these problems. Okay, moving on. I want to talk about I/O now, because there's a whole other set of this that goes along with I/O. So let's talk a bit about sockets first, because networking I/O is actually straightforward. So here we have our virtual thread is actually going to attempt to establish a TCP connection. In this case is FOSDEM port 443, so it's the SSL port. Okay, what happens there? So same diagram as before. We've got our carrier at the top, and then we've got our green frames for the virtual thread. We're doing a socket. We're in the socket constructor, which actually initiates the connect. What does the connect actually do when you're on the virtual thread? It's actually going to initiate the connection, arm the file descriptor, and then do a yield so that the carrier can be released to actually go and do other work. So this is what our stack would actually look like. It goes down through the I/O code and NIO code and does our yield. Carrier gets released to go and do other work. We're all good. What we have then in the background is the way things work for the moment is there is this thing called a polar thread. The polar thread interacts with whatever the I/O mechanism is on the platform. There's implementations for EPOL and KQ. There's one that integrates with the Windows WinSock driver. And what it does is it's just listening for events. When there's events from the operating system to tell you that that these are already events, then it just it unblocks the corresponding virtual thread. It unparks it and just queues its tasks to the scheduler and things just work. That little diagram over there, did you see that little spinning? I'm going to reuse that in a couple of slides. Essentially, all that's doing is listening for events, unparking thread, listening for events, unparking thread, listening for, and so on. That's all it does. But back to our example here we're trying to establish a connection. The connection is now established. Because we've done a wake up, we pop all the frames. We're gone past the socket constructor now, and we're all good. So this is kind of the way things work today in JDK 21. You've got this thread that's picking up I/O events. It's queuing up the corresponding virtual threads to the scheduler. In this case, I've depicted as a box full of carrier threads. That's actually not all that efficient, because there's a number of issues with this once you actually start scaling things up. Particularly, you've got a number of carrier threads that correspond to the number of cores, and then you've got these other polar threads that are actually trying to compete for CPU cycles. You've also got the issue where you're picking up I/O events on one thread, but it's actually going to end up being processed on a different thread. So this is there's room for efficiency on this. So one of the things we actually have done in JDK 22 is we magically moved these polar threads, at least on some platforms, from being platform threads to being virtual threads. Now, the implications for that is they actually integrate then with the scheduler. You're only picking up I/O events and queuing up virtual threads to unpark when there's actually cycles to go and do that. In addition, because of the way this polar thread is actually written is it will actually, most of the time, continue the I/O operation on the same thread that picked up the event. So you avoid having to actually go and dealing with events going between threads. When you actually scale it up, this is actually kind of what it actually goes and looks like, is there's actually n polar threads that are virtual threads that are actually, and then there's this other gutter guy in the background, which is when it has to wake up polar threads when there's nothing else for them to go and do. And this is actually quite nice. There's a nice paper written by there's a team in the University of Waterloo that actually work in this sort of similar area on their own library for lightweight threads in C++. And they've got an interesting paper which deals with all the I/O strategies, and this is kind of one of the I/O strategies that they're also using by default. So that's Martin Carnson's team in Waterloo. It's, the paper is "Have Your Cake and Eat It," which is a great title for a paper. So this is actually turns out in some benchmarks turns out to be actually quite very, very profitable. This is just some random benchmark that's actually sending a 1K request and getting a 16K response. It's on the loop back. There's a client and a server thread for each one of these. So there's a lot of parking actually going on. There's a lot of I/O between them. But the nice thing is we actually see improvements, significant improvements on a range of systems, which is actually quite good. Okay, moving on, I want to talk about a bit of file I/O, because this is where we actually put on our sad face, because it's not as good a story. So the example I'm actually using on this one is I'm opening a file. So this is code executing on a virtual thread. I'm doing a file open here, and I'm doing a file read. So two file operations. Down on the right, I'm just showing the box with the, let's assume this is a four core system. There's four carrier threads actually sitting there. So what actually happens today, and it's a bit lame, but I'm just explaining the way it actually works today, is when you attempt to do a file I/O operation that may actually consume the thread, it temporarily increases the parallelism, which will trigger an additional worker thread to be available to do other work. So if you've ever seen fork join pool manage blocker, this is essentially the same thing with your actual compensation that actually can happen in managed blocking operations. So when you do your file open, your thread is actually unavailable to do other work. And then when the file I/O operation completes, you decrement the parallelism again. And what happens is that the number of worker threads that are available reverts back to where it actually was. These additional extra worker threads that might get created for these, they might hang around for a little while, but they will eventually terminate once the system is at quiescence. So same thing, what happens when we to do a file I/O, or sorry, we do a read, same kind of thing, increase the parallelism, and we do our read, and once the read is actually complete, we will decrement the parallelism again. So this is all kind of lame, and you would say, well, why haven't we done any better on this? So this is one of the things that we actually have been playing around with for quite some time. There are asynchronous I/O interfaces on different operating systems. I'll just talk about what for IOU ring today. I'm just talking about in the context of file. We've also looked at it in the context of sockets as well. So in the Linux operating system, there's a completely different type of interface to the operating system, which supports asynchronous I/O operations. It essentially allows the trap into the kernel, so you've actually you can actually queue up submissions in memory, and any events that are associated with those when they complete are actually queued up in a ring. That's also, so it's accessible from both the kernel and user space. There's a lot of issues and a lot of complications trying to interface this to the JDK to be able to support a lot of the libraries. So what we have been doing, and this is in the OpenJDK sandbox, is we have a low level API which sits on top of the work that Maurizio was talking about in the previous slide, our previous presentation with FFM, and that will provide the lower level access to the submission and the completion rings, and it hides a lot of that kind of detail. Now, in order to be able to work this with virtual threads, we actually have to do a bit more replacing of foundations around the place. So there's a lot of prototype re-implementation of a lot of the Java I/O classes, and to be able to work with this as well, and that actually allows the problem of file I/O to be actually reduced down very significantly. None of the completed bits for this are in the Loom repo yet, but we will get there eventually. There's a bunch of design choices that have to be worked out when you're actually interfacing with something like IOUing, because as to which threads can actually access IOUing is not kind of designed for multiple threads to be accessing a ring at the same time. So what we will end up doing is having essentially multiple IO ring instances, one per carrier essentially, and that actually fixes the submission side. The completion side is a little bit more complicated, and there's a number of design choices around that. So the main message here is that there's a lot going on in this area as well, because all of that areas of the libraries have to play cleanly with virtual threads as well. Okay, so I'm not going to go through all of the other things that are going on, but I'll just mention a few of them. So Professor Doug Lee, who's a world expert on concurrency, is doing quite a bit of work at the exploration into fork join pool at the moment. For scenarios where you have a smaller number of cores, because a lot of container and cloudy type systems, you're running with two or you're running with four cores. And we've observed in many scenarios where you get underutilization. And a lot of that relates to just the time it actually takes to worker threads are parking, and then they have to be unparked in order to actually do work. So he's exploring a number of things on that. We're trying to come up with good benchmarks to be able to measure these kind of things. But this should, if this turns out to be profitable, then it'll help some of these scenarios where we appear not to be having full utilization on smaller systems. JVMTI makes me scream. It's a very, very invasive API, and it's very much challenged by features in the Java platform where you move them out of the VM into Java. So having a native tool interface where a lot of the runtime is actually in Java rather than in the VM is a challenge. We have a very good story for JVMTI and virtual threads and debugging, and for many other types of tool agents, but it's not working well for profiler type tools that want to use JVMTI, because it's having to coordinate with a lot of code that's actually executing in Java. So there's a lot of work going on there to try to solve some of the problems. It's one where there's been some progress made, but it's one that's going to take more time. There's other efforts that I'm not going to talk about today, which is around scope values, which essentially allows us to communicate something to a remote callee without having parameters in the call frames. And Raheli is actually leading that effort in Project Loom. Then we have the other big area, which is structured concurrency, which is all about being able to coordinate multiple threads that are decomposed running some operation, is be able to deal with them as a single unit of work. So there's a lot of interesting things going on there. That API is currently in preview, and we will have to do another preview of this for the next release. So these are other kind of efforts that are actually going on in this project at the moment. So that's kind of it. I think I've actually made it in with a few minutes to spare. And this is sort of links to the current JEPs that we have, the repository. And when I was talking about the work on the monitors and some of the other changes around fork join pool, they're accumulating in the Loom repo now. And yeah, okay. You'll have to hand out microphones. I can. Okay.
Hello. Hello. Test. Right. Yes.
Hello. I have to take questions here first. I think.
Okay. All right. I had a question on, can you hear me at all?
Okay.
Quiet, please, quiet, please.
So you mentioned on for network I/O, you said you had a good solution, right? And then you said for file I/O, things are much trickier. But what
we can't, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Would you mind repeating it?
Yes. So I was saying, so you mentioned network I/O and you said, yeah, we have a pretty good solution here, but for file I/O, things are much trickier. But what's the fundamental issue that, say, the solution for network I/O cannot be used for file I/O too?
Okay. So the question is why is the solution for why can't the solution for network I/O be used for file I/O? And that is because there isn't the equivalent sort of readiness API that you get for non-blocking I/O. So the reverse works, but not what we're able to do at the moment is we're able to actually to map onto multiple different 20 years of scalable I/O mechanisms for networking I/O. There isn't really the equivalent for file I/O.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
So, simple question. When you solve these problems and get a good implementation and it's all in the next version of Java and you've solved all of these problems, what do you think is going to be the impact? What are you aiming for?
Okay, so the ultimate goal is for Java developers to be able to write code that reads exactly how it actually executes. So we want to avoid having complicated, hard to read, hard to debug code that you get to, that people are actually forced to write today with asynchronous I/O or reactive. That's sort of the ultimate goal with this. So get the scalability with very obvious, easy to read code, and at the same time is harmonious with all the other parts of the platform, such as debugging and profiling and so on. Because one of the things you actually lose today when you start going down the async type route is you lose so much of the tooling, you lose your debugging, you lose your profiling. We want to bring all of that back so that everything just works. What we have today in 21 is actually pretty good. You have a large range of applications can actually be developed and scaled very, very well. But there's quite a other amount of code that we want to get running with virtual threads too.
First, thank you so much. I think like suffering of millions will end with this holy light. My question is, when you look at the mitigation techniques that are recommended against the shortcoming of monitors, one of like the primary thing is you're just recommending people to replace those with locks. Just use a lock.
Okay, that's a good observation. So in JEP 4, in JEP 444, which is the Java enhancement proposal that introduced virtual threads as a permanent feature, it suggests that if you're running into issues with pinning with object monitors, you can just replace them with JavaChill concurrent locks. And that was very much kind of short-term advice in order to actually to avoid the quality of implementation issue. But we never said we'd never fix this problem. It was a tactical decision to make the feature permanent without addressing the monitors issue.
No, I very well understand solution. It was just felt to me like it sounds like something machine should be doing. Like, why doesn't the VM replace it with a lock on behalf of me?
Right. So what you're asking is why doesn't the VM magically replace it? There's a lot of issues with doing something like that. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, there's one other.
With all the work going into addressing issues with monitors and pinning, will constructs living inside Java util concurrent also benefit from that work, or is that isolated from each other?
Okay, so Java Chill Concurrent does not base itself on does, does, doesn't